Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, iconic young adult author Gary Paulson discusses his new middle grade memoir, Gone to the Woods, his own survival story. He is joined by children's book author and librarian Betsy Bird. This program took place January 12, 2021 and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. We're here this evening to talk with one of this country's most beloved tellers of tales on the publication day of his new book. Gary Paulson is a three-time Newbery Honor Award winner and author of some of America's best-loved works for young people, including the Hatchet series. Tonight, he's presenting his own story in memoir with Gone to the Woods. Kirker's Reviews called Gone to the Woods rich and compelling, both brightly funny and darkly tragic. It is fresh in its honest portrayal of difficult themes. He's being interviewed tonight by Betsy Bird, who's a children's book author, podcast host, blogger, and librarian. She's the author or editor of six books, including Funny Girl, Funniest Stories Ever, The Great Santa Stakeout, and Wild Things, Acts of Mischief in Children's Literature. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's really good to be here. Really
it's
good.
Really nice to have you. Yeah. Have you been doing the virtual rounds with your latest book?
Virtually. I've just been watching reviews, which is fun. And in my case, not yet. Not so much yet. Some they're going around, but mostly I'm just dazzled, I think is the word.
Well, where are you right now?
I'm in the mountains in New Mexico. In fact, this is the situation. If the power goes off, cell phones don't work here. And I have to jump in my truck and drive 18 and a half miles out into the flats of the desert, and the cell phone will work there, and I can call somebody back and say the power's off and my phone and computers are dead. So if I suddenly disappear, that's what happened. Okay. Although it's kind of holding now, it's doing better.
That's good.
I'm in the mountains, high mountains of New Mexico, surrounded by peaks, alone. I don't even have my dog up here now.
Well, and what's the temperature supposed to reach there?
Well, it's supposed to get down to 8 tonight, which is not something I'm happy with, but I used to love it, too. Mm-hmm. I loved the cold. I used to run in blizzards with the dogs. Oh, well.
That's all right.
A different life.
And speaking of lives, you like that? Like that segue?
That was good. That was really good.
I'm feeling pretty good about it. And then I ruined it by pointing it out. So there you go.
No.
You know, it's in some ways, it's to be unfortunate in your childhood is to be fortunate in the content of your memoir that you write someday. There are many memoirs written by children's authors for kids about themselves. And very, very few hold a candle to what you have lived yourself. Why are you writing this book now? And how long have you been writing it?
I've written about parts of my childhood and parts of my life earlier, not in third person, but first person. In this case, there are pivotal points. I'm gesturing. Can that be shown? I don't. Anyway, there are pivotal points that have affected my life. One of them was the first section of the book. Then there's that brief bit taking the ship to the Philippines, and then the army, of course, and my teenage years, 13. All those are critical points in my life, and I wanted to write about them as a flow, showing all those things. Now, the reason it's third person, first person biographies, you tend to want to change it and say it was a bigger fish, or it really wasn't that bad, or it's worse, or something. And I thought by getting detached a little bit, I could have more clarity, and it worked. I actually was surprised sometimes at how well it worked. I kept thinking, I hope the little bugger makes it, and about myself. I really did. I would remember things that were just horrific, and things I would not want to see now, even as an adult, but I was astonished that I got through them. I really was. At the time, they just were part of my life, you know, and I went on.
I was going to ask that. At the time, did you realize how horrific? Because the book begins, I should say, you're five, and your mom is putting you on a train that alone to go visit, not visit, to stay with relatives you've never met before, and you're on the same train as soldiers coming back from the war who are not well.
They've been hit. They've been blown apart and stuff. My father was in Europe at that time fighting with the Germans, against the Germans with Patton. He was on Patton's staff, a low-level staff officer. I didn't meet him until I was seven. Excuse me. But I just was immersed in a kind of an immense curiosity about everything. And I would sometimes ask them, I didn't do this a lot in the book, but if they'd known my father, did they see my father? Because I had not seen him. And I'd seen one picture of him, a phony photograph that had been tinted. That's all I saw of him. I didn't think of it as strange then. Sometimes I was afraid. There was fear. But in the Philippines, I saw men killed by machine guns. What's bizarre is that I was 7, 8 years old when I saw that. 10 years exactly later, I was being taught by the Army how to use machine guns, the same guns. And it makes that complete then, makes it whole. Sometime later from that, I was fighting, in a sense, in aerospace. I was a field engineer in electronics and satellite tracking and stuff. We were putting satellites over Russia, and we were at war. Nobody knew it, but we were. We worked constantly for 12 hours a day for months and months and months because of that. And I realized how stupid war was, so that's the same thing. That started with the machine guns and all the way to where I finally figured out war sucked. It was just awful, and it can't be justified.
Well, let's back it up a little bit, because there's a lot of people who just don't know what the book covers. So this is your story, written in, as you said, in the third person. What span of your life does it cover? Because sometimes when people write memoirs, it's just a little chunk of their life in the middle of a larger whole. Sometimes they go from birth to right now. What are you covering in this book?
It pretty much goes from birth to now, or close to now. Mm-hmm. Starting at about 5 when I was put on the train. You forgot to mention, I thought maybe I left it out, that my mother put a $5 bill in my pocket, too, for the trip. I can't believe I made that. And then on a farm with my aunt and uncle, who were just wonderful.
From Chicago. So you were going from Chicago.
I went from Chicago to. I did not know where I was in Chicago. That's one of your questions.
I was going to ask, where in Chicago?
I don't. My mother worked in a munitions plant. I thought there was an elevated railway nearby, but I don't know that there was elevated. I just thought
just
it was.
Put it down. Okay.
No. Yeah. But it was some kind of awful one room thing that we lived in. It wasn't very nice. And bars. We lived in bars too. I spent a lot of time in bars. I just recently found a picture. Nobody's seen it but me right now, but of myself in my Army uniform when I was 4 years old, 3 and 4 years old. She'd have me sing in bars. Mm-hmm. I'd stand up in bars. And the rank in the little picture is sergeant. And when I was in the Army, I made sergeant, which is a hoot. I didn't deserve it, and I don't know why they made me a sergeant. But
there seems to be a circular literary hole to
apparently. Some of it, I was talking about this to somebody else recently, but I've had a life of extremes. My first dog sled race was the Iditarod, 1,200 miles across Alaska alone with a dog team. My first Harley I bought in Mexico, El Paso, Texas, and took it up to Fairbanks, Alaska and back just to check it out. I mean, it's insane. First sailboat, I sailed to Fiji. I decided that the word that would qualify for all those is oops. God, I got wrecked. I broke both legs. I broke my arms. I mean, I was a mess. I had a moose kick teeth out back here. I still don't have teeth back here. They kick hard. They kick really hard.
And,
I was so mad at her. It's a little college, about 400 pounds. Bulls get 1,600. I mean, it's the same with little.
Do you have a baby? Why was she kicking your teeth in?
No, they're just mean.
Oh, okay.
They're just Alaska. They had one chase me in the house once, into the porch, trying to get me. I don't know. Maybe I'm anti-moose or something. I don't know. And she stayed with me close, so she'd chew on Willow's watching me. If I moved, she started kicking me again. The dog teams had gone another 100 yards and got tangled. Uh-huh. And I didn't have a weapon or anything, so off she went later. If I could have found her. Never mind.
This is the problem with talking with you, because I'm like, I've got all these questions I should be asking you, and now all
I'm
I
sorry.
Want to talk about. Sorry. No, it's just like we're in very big danger of this turning into an entirely moose-based discussion. So I'm going to re-extricate myself, okay. Even though this is freaking fascinating. Okay, yeah. But no, it's funny. Well, it's funny. I was preparing these questions earlier today, and at the same time, I was doing my job. I'm a librarian, and I buy books, and I was I read the reviews as I was doing. I was reading this Kirkus review of a memoir, and the reviewer, you know, they're anonymous, so you know, hat tip to you, anonymous reviewer. They wrote this about the book they were talking about, but I kept thinking about your book. They said that when it comes to memoirs, quote, the most indelible qualities of the genre, an ability to inhabit a version of oneself that no longer exists, an instinct for what's important and what isn't, and a voice that implies personal growth gained through missteps and ultimately self-knowledge. And I wondered if you agreed with this. I mean, does this book...
I don't agree. Some of it... What, again, the machine gun. 8 years old, I saw it work. How awful they are. 10 years later, I was being taught how to use them. And I was good with them. Out to 1,500 yards, I could hit a man-sized silhouette every time, a mile away. Again, later, the same person decides that war sucks and is awful. Now, that doesn't go away. It's just... is encompassed. I'm still the kid. I didn't become another thing as I gained longevity. I was going to not say grow, but I never really grew. I stayed as that child all the way along, being exposed to different things. But they're still there. I'm still the same person. I didn't lose my identity at all. It became more full and sometimes confusing, of course, But you see things later that jerk you back to some points in that time. I worked in Colorado for a while as a voluntary ambulance driver, and I got every traffic wreck and every heart attack. And I mean, I was always alone because I was home all the time writing. So I just answered, I'd go and get the wagon and go, you know. And I've never written about that stuff. I'm not going to, but it would jump my mind back to things that had happened in the Philippines or things that had happened at that way, you know. So it's still there. It's still all there. It grows. And I'm not quite done with it.
Well, that's my question. I mean, yeah. Is there any chance of a sequel? I mean,
I don't know if sequel would be the word.
It's
the next
companion novel.
I'm going to write, well, the next book that's going to be published is already written, is with them now, The North Wind. Well, the next book is How to Train Your Dad, or Boy, okay. And that's a comedy. Mm-hmm. And it's a hoot. I had fun. I laughed when I was writing it. Do you want me to talk about it all?
Yeah, what's the plot?
Okay, this boy has a perfect father, except that he's off the grid. He just lives at garage sales and dumpsters and stuff. But he loves his father, but he's got to change. He's got sometimes mismatched tennis shoes or wearing bibs that say juicy across the butt that belong to a girl, that kind of thing. And he wants to get normal clothes and be a normal person, but they don't have money. And so he decides he's dumping dog food out of a sack into a can, and a pamphlet falls out of the dog food sack. And it's How to Train Your Puppy Using Positive Reinforcement. And so he says, his friend tells him, you got to reboot your dad. You just got to change him. So they go through this whole thing. The book is him rebooting his father using puppy training as a way to do it. And it, there are other characters in the book, a biker and a pit bull that they own named Carol, who is all dogs look at your right eye for your emotions. All dogs. No wolves, no fox, no other canine does. But all dogs will study a person's right eye and can tell what they're thinking and what they're going to do. And you see, even puppies, you put a puppy down, that right eye is locked on. So this pit bull would study the boy's right eye all the time. And then she loved garage sales, and she'd keep him from going to garage sales. I had a blast writing this thing. Anyway, it's the next book out. And then after that is Northwind, which is it's kind of a survival story. It's really not like Hatchet at all, but the sea. It's about the sea and Norwegian Norsky stuff.
Norwegians are very in right now. Do you consciously shift tone when you write? You're like, you write this, I have to assume it was an emotional thing to write.
Yep.
And then you write a comedy right after that. And then you go into something a little more serious after that. Do you do that consciously, or is that just how it naturally comes out for you?
I think the original story was somebody put bloody skins on his back and danced around the fire and said what the hunt was like. Told the story of that. Later that became words. Later it became writing. Later it became art. But the story is the same. The story is sacrosanct, I think. Now, whatever you need to tell that story, the way it can be told best is fair. Is fair. So I studied rhythms and pacing, and I used that in some books, some in this. I studied changes in character. There's an enormous difference between the writer of Shakespeare and Harry Potter. They're both good. They're potentially good. I'm not saying either one is bad or good, but they're both human. They're both using words to do essentially the same thing, tell the story. And so that's what I do. If it's a comedy book, I don't have machine guns. You know, if it's...
Good.
Exactly.
I'm for that choice, yeah.
The third book, the Northwind book, has whales. Mm. And they're all things that happened to me. I sailed a boat from Ventura, California, up the West Coast. I'm gesturing here, but up the West Coast, completely went into Juan de Fuca, went all the way up the inside to Alaska, and came down the outside. And you need time, right? I'm sorry. And that's the book is about a person doing that same thing.
Yeah.
So, and it's told in a more serious vein, including some runes, Scandinavian runes and carvings. I'm leaving vague here, but I think I better be because we haven't combined. The book is done, but it needs to be gone over and edited and stuff with Mel or with Wes. It's not Mel. His name is Wes.
Yeah. And he's new, right? You have a new editor, right?
Wes Adams.
How did you find him?
My agent found him. She knew about him and then put us together. Before all this happened, we just got on the phone. I have a phone over here. And I sat and talked to him for a long time. We talked together before the contract, before anything like that. The editor that I had at another place, David Gale, had passed away. And I loved Dale, and it was heartbreaking. And Wes kind of fit in. And a woman that I know who was interviewing me said, "You're going to love Wes." And I thought, well, I've been around a while, and blah, blah, you know, kind of a smart aleck. Sorry. She's dead right. He brings a kind of song to books now that is coming back as part of writing. I just love it. I'm having an incredibly good time with it. I really am.
Are you going to do more books with him?
I'm just going to write till I die.
Mm-hmm.
probably about Thursday at 4 o'clock, but I'm hoping for a little longer than that, but we'll see. Yeah, I'm going to work.
You've got enough content from, even if you just like pull from your life, you've got enough content to just go forever. Half the stuff you're telling me about isn't even in your books. It's just.
No, it isn't. I mean, you can write about a gate. You can write about a single thing and do a whole book. So when you start these stories, it might be about one little thing, one sentence that a person says or an action they do or believe. Hemingway was writing about Immovable Feast. I'm not telling Hemingway he's a jerk. I wouldn't like him probably personally. Yeah, shooting animals, come on. And the bull thing is stupid. But anyway, he's writing about F. Scott Fitzgerald's talent. And he said it was like the dust on a butterfly's wing. And when it was gone, he didn't know, and he kept beating his wings. And I thought, how does he even think that? How does his brain do that, Hemingway? I mean, it just doesn't seem like it could come from him. And it did. And so I've read Moby Dick, I think, 4 times. And it was a bust. He didn't make any money on it. He starved. Well, he died in poverty. Nobody wanted the book. It's a giant book. It's probably the greatest American novel ever done. It's just astonishing. And it starts with 3 words. Call me Ishmael. My God. I mean, seriously. They were taking whole pages to describe part of a dress. You know, a hem on a dress might take 5 pages with Jane Austen or something, but here's this guy, Call Me Ishmael, and bow, just gone, the rhythms. Perfect.
Well, and you started out writing for adults.
I did. I wrote Westerns and Mysteries. I had to learn. I'm going to back up a little. I know you asked about the librarian. The librarian to me.
There's one in the book, yeah.
Yeah. That's life and death. Seriously. Without what she did for me, I would be dead.
Explain what she did for you.
I was a poor reader and I flunked everything. I was flunking in school. I just didn't go. Teachers tried, but it was a nightmare. And just my home life was some god-awful thing that just terrible, drunken, screaming fits, you know, and stuff. My parents were awful. And the library became a sanctuary. This is warm. It was in a small town in the north and cold in the winter. And I'd go in there to get warm and get away from the bullies. And she saw me there one day and asked me if I wanted a book. And I was a smart ass. I said, yeah, I'll take one. And I don't remember what it was. She gave me a book and I felt honor-bound to read it. And I was a poor reader. I took it home and I staggered through the thing. I'd have to read page 2 over and over, and then page 3, and then poetry, like that. And I don't remember a thing about the book, except I got all the way through it, and I took it back. And she gave me another book, and then another book, and then a book a week, and 2 books a week. And then she'd throw in a Dickens or a Melville. And I would be in prison or dead without that. It was that critical. The school didn't work. The state stepped in, as they do, because I just didn't go to school. And they said, so that I would not be a burden in society, that's a quote, I should either take a vocational course for auto repair or television repair. Well, I'd been goofing around with ham radio with a friend of mine, so I kind of knew about electronics. So I did have television repair. God, I wish I'd done car repair. I don't know anything about cars. And you can't fix TVs now anyway, so it's just a wasted career, you know. But because of that, the tests I took in the Army had me as a technical genius, and I went to every class. Here's one for you. A kid from a troubled family, 18 years old, is taught how to arm and use a nuclear weapon. I mean, I was good at it. I could do that. I could arm and use a nuclear weapon and take a city, a whole city, if I had a bad day. Jeez. I mean, Matt, that was not the Army where you can be all you can be type thing. It was a different Army. And I got $78 a month, which is big money.
Oh, what's this? I got a Ticonderoga here. I believe that librarian handed you.
There's a bright yellow pencil, and she sharpened it.
Which this is not as sharp, but yes. And what did she tell you to do with that Ticonderoga pencil?
I should write down my thought pictures. I told her about things in the woods because I do in the woods or the library, right. or the streets between. I also set pins in a bowling alley. Which is like a firefight, very dangerous. And I started telling her about things in the woods that I would see, like deer and stuff like that. And she asked me once, she said, you should write those down. I said, for who? And she said, me. Nobody gave me anything. Nobody. Parents, nobody. And she gave me a library card. Spelled my name right. Little embossed thing. And it's my identity. It's what I became. It what God. You just have no idea. You really don't. It wasn't just pivotal. It was everything. I started to read then. David Gale and I were on a tour in Portland. I was giving a talk to, 300-400 people. And I had done a book about Nam favoring soldiers because they were being spit on and stuff. And I'd done a one-shot magazine about it. And this guy came in the back, and sometimes things would get physical sometimes. And if you did it, you did it. You did what you had to do. So this guy comes in the back of the thing, and I saw Levi's in a T-shirt, and he hands an envelope, and he hands it to David and walks out. And I thought, well, that's okay. Later, we're in the hotel lobby waiting for a car to take us to the airport, the big circular fountain thing. And he says, oh, this man handed me this for you. And it was a letter from this guy who had been illiterate. And he'd read Hatchet. And it was the first book he ever read. He's about 30. And he wrote two letters. One to his son, telling him that he could read, and one to me. Yeah. I could think of the library when that happened. David and I bawling, just tears rolling down, hugging each other. God knows what people thought going by, they'd stare at us, you know. We're both crying, just tears going down. And that came from the library. That came from the librarian all the way back. The blue scripto pad, little pad, blue scripto, and a yellow pencil. Ticonderoga, number two. Ta-da. Right there.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be here.
This was great. This was just fantastic.
It was. I agree. Keep writing.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we'll air a conversation with iconic crime fiction novelist Walter Mosley about his life and work that was recorded in 2018. Mosley's next E.Z. Rollins mystery, Blood Grove, comes out February 2nd. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.